Hello, welcome to Greenlit, with me, the voice which belongs to Toby Earle. Each fortnight on Greenlit, a guest receives the thrilling news their life is to be made into a biopic, and we discuss how that story will be told. Will they star? Which moments won't make it into the adaptation? And will Dracula make an appearance? In this episode, author, comedy writer, and former stand-up Nick Pettigrew will plot the course of this certain blockbuster. Pettigrew is the author of the best-selling Antisocial, The Secret Diary of an Antisocial Behaviour Officer, was a Daily Mash writer for several years, and his spoon collection is one of the grandest in southern England, numbering in excess of 5 spoons. Nick Pettigrew, welcome to Greenlit.
Hello, thank you for that introduction, although my house insurance has now gone through the roof.
I mean, over 5 spoons.
If my grandparents were alive to see that, you know, it's like the American dream come true.
Isn't it, though? Yeah. I mean, it would only be your grandparents and you, though, because, oh, and actually, you've got more than 5, so maybe up to 6 people could all share a dessert.
There's one spare. It's luxury. It's just...
Well, thank you. Thanks for joining us on Greenlit. Nick, is it pronounced biopic or biopic?
Oh, God, I flip-flop on this. I don't know, biopic or biopic. I think biopic is the one I sort of gravitate towards. Because I think recently as well, because I've got to the age where I now need reading glasses. Oh. So I just think the word myopic is in my head, and I'm just making that connection.
When did you, how long ago did you have to start wearing your readers?
My readers, in the last couple of weeks. It was really weird. I watch television in bed a lot, and I bought a tablet, like an Amazon tablet. And I was like, oh, God, the picture on this isn't very good compared to the last one. And then I realised, you know, I couldn't read properly. So I put the reading glasses on. And I was like, oh, no, it's a really good picture. I've just got to see the times.
Now, do you have quasi-academic half-moon type readers?
On a chain around my neck and everything. Yeah, the full...
Yeah. Yeah,
you've got to go full on with it.
Do you like having them around your neck, or do you pop them on the top of your head? You know, is there a preferred way of wearing them when you're not wearing them?
I'm more of on top of the head, because with a chain, what you can't do is take them off and sort of make emphasis points with, you know, by prodding the air with them, you see. So there's all that to do as well. I mean, there's a whole world of glasses use I'm getting to learn. But I did the thing of buying really cheap ones, because I know I've got ADHD, I will lose them, so I'm not going to get proper ones just yet.
Right, you don't want to invest in a pair of designer readers.
No. It's like, you know, these people who have Mont Blanc pens, I just think that is... I may as well just take £1,000 and flush it down the toilet.
I mean, that is kind of a budget version of what the KLF did, and I'd watch that still. I mean, I would still watch someone. I would still watch someone flush £1,000 down the toilet. With your glasses, are you a arm chewer? Do you like to get the end of the arm and chew it while you're thinking about either what to have for dinner or maybe how to sleaze your way into the House of Lords?
Not yet. I've not chewed it yet. I think my current signature move is the Tommy Lee Jones peer over the top in stain and disgust. It's a still that always gets used on Twitter. He's a police officer, and he's got like a cowboy hat on. But yeah, there's that photograph of Tommy Lee Jones where he's just peering over his glasses, and it's not the same film, but it's that brilliant quote from Tommy Lee Jones when he was working with Jim Carrey on one of the Batman films, and he sat him down and went, "I cannot sanction your buffoonery."
That was Batman Forever, where he played Two-Face, which, curiously enough that you mentioned that, I actually caught the end of that the other day, and it was worse than I remember, and which is kind of incredible. And it was the final sequence in the Riddler's hideout on this sort of island off of Gotham City. And what I found so astonishing about it is the aesthetic of it. It's a Schumacher, lots of neon. But what was really astonishing, I found, was that the Riddler, who has this master plan to enslave humanity through having these set-top boxes where he can like drain the thoughts in their brains and then project these images, which kind of keep them hypnotized. He seems to have spent a huge amount of time, the Riddler, building a lighting rig inside his lair with stands that you see on top of the pots and, you know, concerts and whatnot, with the lights spinning around. Like, why have you spent so long building a lighting rig in your lair? Like it's such a specific thing to do. And what was then that obviously there's a lot of issues around that film, but that was like one that really got me. And then it also was amazingly for a film which cost a lot of money, it looked so empty. It was so empty. And I don't know if it accidentally was a metaphor for the film itself.
It always had that air of a nightclub that's not doing well.
Yeah.
On a Tuesday night. It has that kind of feel to it, doesn't it? It's sort of tawdry glamour. But no, I like the idea of him having, you know, his monthly budget meetings with his accountant. Yeah. Like, okay, well, you know, wages for henchmen, fine, I get that. You know, the set top box in Slay the World thing, okay. Lighting rigs, why are we... It's like 20% of your budget's going on lighting rigs.
Riddler, I've got to say that the lasers you've ordered, they look great. They look, the question mark look brilliant. But it's honestly the
Pink
power
you fucked off with you. They really are not happy at all because they can't tour while you've got them. But is that part of the plan to annoy Pink Floyd?
I mean, thankfully that we never saw the third in Schumacher's Batman trilogy, and that could well have been Batman versus Floyd or something, or the Riddler versus. I mean,
do the Schwarzenegger Uma Thurman one? Was that him?
Batman and Robin, yeah.
Which I've never seen. I can't.
Well, when we'll launch another podcast all about that because there's an awful lot to pick apart in that one. But
I've seen the little clips like where he has the American Express card.
Oh,
that made me cringe my body inside out. So I couldn't face 90 minutes of that.
Shudderingly awful. And I was sat in the cinema when that happened. I almost felt my chair wince. It was summer 97, I think. Yeah.
I've never done it out loud because when I go to the cinema, I'm very sort of respectful of the rules and everything. But there are those moments in films where I have not verbalized, but my mouth has gone, oh, fuck off. it's just where you go, oh, come on. Recently, it was the last Star Wars film I remember. I don't want to spoil it. They got ahead of me. But there's a bit where, they're not dead after all, and go, oh, fuck off.
Yeah. Was it, what about the space horses riding up the side of the
space? By that point, I was like, do you know, yeah, all right, whatever, fine. But yeah, space horses, of course, why not?
And speaking about big blockbuster films, you're going to be meeting studio executives to discuss how you're going to make the Nick Pettigrew biopic. Mm-hmm. So where are you going to have that meeting, Nick? Are you going to have it in an office? Are you going to have it at the studio? Are you going to have it at the executives' offices? Are you going to have it at a restaurant? Where would you like the meeting?
Who's paying?
Oh, very much the studio, but you call the shots.
Well, I heard there's a really good conference suite with very good facilities in the Maldives, apparently. So I think that would be sensible. And I think we're probably halfway between the two geographically. So that seems like a sensible place to meet in the middle.
Very fair. Would you insist on everyone being shoeless? Would it be barefoot, the meeting?
I think flip-flops. I think we can go as informal as flip-flops, certainly. You know,
business espadrilles?
I didn't even know that was a thing. That sounds like a song by The Fall, but okay. I'm not going to sort of take the mic. I'll bring the biscuits.
Just out of curiosity, what sort of biscuits for a high-level Hollywood executive meeting? What type of biscuit?
Do you know what? I'm not even going to say hobnobs. I'm going to say chocolate hobnobs. Go for broke. That and the chocolate Leibniz ones. Do you know what I mean? Although in the Maldives, it's about 40 degrees. Chocolate might not be a good idea.
Yeah. I mean, a chocolate Leibniz to me is, even the royal family only break them out at Christmas.
Yeah. And it's like, it's one each, you know, it's very carefully one each and put them back in the box.
Well, exciting news, Nick, your life has been greenlit for a biopic, but how would your life be told by Hollywood or Bollywood or Nollywood? And what sort of creative control would you exercise in bringing the greatest story, you know, to the big screen? So Nick, what's the film called? What is the Nick Pettigrew biopic called?
You can go one of two ways, I think. I've always liked the story about the life of Brian when they were first thinking about it, because initially it was going to be the biopic of Jesus.
Yeah.
And I think it was Eric Idle said we wanted to call it Jesus, Lust for Glory. but my brain always goes to the downbeat. So I think my biopic is going to be called, sorry about that.
now? What is that apology born out of? Why is this that synonymous with Nick Pettigrew?
I just think it's just handy to have up front, you know, because for the next, however, because I don't know how long the film would be, but say 2 hours, or if it's a Marvel film, 4 hours, there's going to be a lot of times where I'm going to feel like I need to apologise. But just think having it at the start, it's like a preemptive thing.
Are you an apologetic person? Do you always preface anything with a sorry? I know people often think that's quite a British trait to sort of apologise before anything's even happened.
I am a classic, you know, I've apologised to doors and bits of furniture and yep. stuff like that for bumping yep. into them. I'd like to think I'm very strident and no nonsense, but yeah, I think I do preface anything. Yeah, sorry for existing, but you know, can I possibly? That's all right. And also, I'm frequently an idiot, so it's perfectly reasonable that I say the word sorry a lot. I think that's if I didn't, then that would be more of a problem.
How frequent do you think you are an idiot? What kind of frequency are we talking about here? Are we talking about clumsiness or just?
Well, I mean, the clumsiness definitely. As I say, I like literally, I think it was 12 months ago, within a week, 12 months ago, I was diagnosed with ADHD, which I didn't know I had. I'd sort of gone through life trying antidepressants, stuff like that. Never really went. So it's only been the last year where I've known that I've got ADHD and I'm sort of medicated on it now and trying to come to terms with it. And a lot of it is making sense. One of them is clumsiness, like physical clumsiness, because I am exceptionally clumsy. I don't have a driving license and my wife has told me that I'm not allowed to. Because she says, look, I see the way you steer yourself along pavements at 3 miles an hour and you weigh about 14 stone. If you were, you know, in control of half a ton of metal, it would be a very, very bad idea. So I am, yeah, very physically clumsy and you know, graceless as well. I've always, if there's one thing ability I wish I had, it'd be physical grace or, you know, being able to play a sport. Because I always say dancing, I look like somebody trying to get a wardrobe through a revolving door. Basically, I just have no sort of physical kind of, as I say, grace or coordination or anything like that. So a lot of the apologies are for, you know, just crashing into stuff and whatnot and breaking things.
Did you feel graceless when you were, say, trying to do sport at school? Did you?
Oh, God, yes. I was, you know, there's the old cliche about being picked last. I was beyond that. I just wasn't picked. Oh, so, like, Nick. You know, they picked the... Oh, no, look, you know, I'd like to think I've got other abilities, but definitely as a kid, I was like the substantial odd boy who doesn't like sport. Yeah, I wasn't even picked. You know, the teams would be picked and they'd go. And I go, well, okay, I guess I'm on one of these two teams then. and, you know, my, because everyone talked about when I played football at school, I was the goalkeeper, I was more of an attacker. My role in the team was just don't go near the ball.
Oh, no.
Just stand there and don't get near the ball. And it was really funny because I love watching sport. Big Liverpool fan, and my wife got me a few years ago as a present. It was a tour of Anfield, and you got to do that. There was a couple of ex-Liverpool players that you met, and part of the day was you went to the Liverpool training ground and you trained with them and you played a five-a-side session.
No way!
Yes, absolutely. So it was, let me get this right, it was Mark Wright and Alan Kennedy were the two ex-pros. So basically you did the training thing, that's okay, whatever. And then it was the five-a-side. So you would have a pro on your side and they sort of mixed and matched the team. So I immediately said, I'll go in goal. You're like, are you sure? Because everyone wants to be out there kicking the ball around. But I went, trust me, it's wasted on me and you'll just get angry with me. So just let me be in goal. I will just stick my arms out when the ball comes near. And that was that. Do you know, I was quite happy with that, rather embarrassing myself. But weirdly, in a freak, like the most coordinated I've ever been in my life, Alan Kennedy, who has scored in a European Cup final,
yeah,
took a shot, which I tipped over the bar. I was like, right, yeah, okay, that's me done. That's the dream.
You must have been buzzing for days. Did you keep the gloves? You must have had the goalie gloves. Did you keep the
gloves? No, I didn't have gloves on. No. There's no point in me having gloves. I just set fire to them or swallow them or something. No. Nothing like that. But the shirt I was wearing, because they signed people's shirts afterwards, and that's not got washed.
Yeah.
Since, definitely.
You say about being graceless and, you know, looking like when you're dancing, trying to get a wardrobe through a revolving door. Have you ever tried to get a wardrobe through a revolving door?
Do you know, I've not. Now I think about it. I need to test that. Whether maybe if I tried to get a wardrobe through a revolving door, I'd look like I was dancing. That might be the answer.
Well, go, every time you go dancing, you know, at discotheques, I believe they're called.
I think what's what the kids call them, isn't it?
That's what the kids call it. Take a revolving door and a wardrobe.
And a wardrobe, yeah. There we go. That's the answer, isn't it?
I do actually have a rule in life, which is, and I don't have many, but one of them is if there is the option to use a revolving door, I always use a revolving door.
Oh, like, there's a normal door next to it. Yeah. Why would you not use the revolving door? Here's the thing, though. Do you have a rule on how, if you're with somebody, how big the sections are, where you take a section each, or you're like, no, we can both fit in this one section?
I think you've got to play it by ear. I think
it's like the IKEA ones are massive, so you can get you can get a wardrobe in there, no problem. You know,
yes.
I think one of the biggest blows to my self-esteem ever was once when a sensor for a sliding door ignored me. genuinely, I walked up and I'm getting closer and closer and closer, and I got to the point where my nose was up against these doors, and it was like a Tesco or something like that, and it just refused to acknowledge I exist. And I was like, all right, well, this is bad, but okay, obviously the doors are broken, and somebody walked from behind me, and they opened for that person. And it's hard not to take that personally.
Did you feel like Bruce Willis in The Sixth Sense? Did you suddenly start thinking, hang on a minute, am I actually...
Am I invisible? Can I just shoplift now? Is that a thing? I don't know.
That was actually, do you know what, that thing of someone not being recognised by a door, I think was used as a running kind of joke or a little kind of aside in the third series of Fargo. Characters. Oh. So congratulations, you've contributed in some way to a great piece of television.
Oh, there we go. Well, you say that was one of the pitfalls of writing, that you've got to accept that there's a limited number of ideas in the world. And I think people get very uptight if something gets made and they go, well, I had that idea. Why did, you know, and because there was years, I mean, this is many, many years ago, 10, 15 years ago, I wrote a sitcom pilot, which I sort of hawked around all the production companies and got either no response at all or a very polite form letter. We've had a look at it, no thanks. So, you know, it just went into a desk drawer and I thought no more about it. Now, see at what point you recognise that maybe, basically the idea was, it was about a person who wasn't a very nice person, who died and ended up in an afterlife where they have to prove they are a nice person and are monitored their behaviour and have somebody looking out for them to see that they are behaving themselves. Now, if that sounds familiar at all, you know, and it was, and it clearly somebody else had the same idea and executed it far better than I have, but I am petty enough that I've never watched a single second of The Good Place. Is that just, you know, you're like, God, that should be me writing that, God damn it. But I think that's the thing about ideas, isn't it? It's never just the idea.
No, it isn't the execution. And speaking about the execution of, sorry about that, with the film title, is that also to kind of keep people guessing, oh, this is the moment that he's kind of apologizing for. But then, of course, 5 or 10 minutes later, there's another moment. So you never, is it always about topping kind of expectation as to what that kind of apology might be for?
Yeah, you know what I mean? It's a constant thing. It's like Chekhov's apology. You have it right at the start over the fireplace, and at some point, you're going to need it. And then, you know, by the end, they didn't enjoy it. You know, I said sorry in advance. You can't get angry.
Do you know what? As a ploy, I was going to say marketing ploy, but I don't think it's necessarily just that. As a ploy to win audiences over,
it's an expectation management.
Yes, it really is. And it kind of gave, well, do you know what? I didn't enjoy it, but fair enough. He'd already apologized.
He was quite nice about it. You know, me not enjoying it in advance. So you know.
Fair. I would maybe not recommend it, but I certainly wouldn't be too angry about it. I'm not asking for my money back. I don't want my money back at the end of it. You said about apologising to furniture. Have you done that recently? Has there been kind of one incident where you've blamed or spoken to a piece of furniture and apologised to something with no one else around you?
I do still speak to Cashpoint machines. That's a hangover from my mum. My mum thanks them every time. And I do have, and again, it's weird what stays with you in life, and it's a more serious point, but if you've had a period or you've grown up in poverty, then even when you escape it, it never goes away. And I guarantee you, you'll know this if you've been in the same position. If you haven't, speak to somebody who grew up poor and ask them what going to a cash point feels like. And they will tell you. Now, at this point, they may be a millionaire and on television. They will tell you, you still got that lurch in your stomach and you still cross your fingers. And like, just, there was a whole routine I had in life when I had no money. There was a machine where it said, do you want to see your balance? And I went, no, of course I fucking don't. You know, like, why would I want to see that? So you get all that. And even to the point where, and this is how illogical it gets, that because for a long period of my life, I was living hand to mouth. And what happens is eventually you've got no money left. So it won't give you any money because that's how capitalism works. But in my head, I would have lucky and unlucky cash machines. So if a cash machine ever said no, we're not giving you any money because you haven't got any, I wouldn't use that one again because that was a bad machine.
Wow.
There's nothing in my account, but I'll give it a try. And then it gave me a tenner. That was a good machine.
Right. Yeah.
And I would thank those. So yeah, it definitely, that's an inanimate object I talk to even now.
Wow. That's an amazing thing to kind of have to have continued to carry with you, to still have that.
Honestly, I mean, I speak, you know, and I have friends that similar backgrounds to me and have not been sort of hand to mouth for literally decades. And he said, no, it never goes away.
Because I think there's an awful lot of that discussion in your book, of course, in Antisocial about living in that way, of course, as well. And do you ever think that will leave you? Do you think there'll ever come a time where it doesn't?
It's less. I mean, clearly it's, you know, I'm not rich as Croesus at the moment, but I'm not struggling. It's the physical lurch of the stomach and the nausea and fear and the sweats. That doesn't happen anymore because I know logically that if I try and get 20 quid out of a cash point, it should do that.
Yeah.
So it's not that ongoing existential dread like sort of in the past, but yeah, I mean, certainly it's only very recently I've stopped crossing my fingers every time I use a cash point, like literally in the last 2-3 years. But no, even now, just that, you know, do you want to see your balance? No, thank you. And you know, it's just general life. It's about struggling to spend money on yourself, which I still, my wife tells me last few months, she caught me on eBay browsing secondhand shirts. She's like, you can probably afford a new shirt now. Like from a shop that nobody's ever worn before. We probably are okay to do that now. And look, you know, it's
that fear as well. Is that, sorry to interrupt, but also, is that a fear of the future? Like maybe this won't last. Maybe I've got to be careful.
Yeah. It could go away again. Cause there's, this is probably more serious conversation than planned, but there have been studies that show that growing up in poverty basically changes your brain structure in a fundamental way. You know, because there's this thing about the feckless poor and, you know, why are people on benefits and why do they run up these debts and all this Tory nonsense? And A, it's not true, but B, it is because that. Because if you're one broken refrigerator or one school uniform that needs replacing away from having no money at all, there is no point in saving. Spend the money while you've got it because you might not have it in the future. And that stays with you and that stays ingrained. But also knowing that at any point something could happen. So the idea of spending money on yourself, it's really difficult because you go, well, what if I buy a shirt for 30 quid? And then next week I will need that 30 quid for food or to put on the electric meter. And I won't. And I can't say I ever will be in that position. But it's learned behavior. It's really hard to get out.
And I just have you ever treated yourself to something? You maybe felt a bit guilty about spending the money, but you got
it. Was and because my wife's similar background, we both do this thing where you browse something for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. Can I justify it? Let's have a look at some more reviews, maybe some YouTube reviews, you know, and
yeah.
And you end up getting it anyway. Do you know what I mean? It was when I'd had the book Antisocial, when I'd sold that and I got the contract and my laptop was dying. I mean, it would take, like I could literally switch it on, go and make a coffee and come back and it was just about booting up. Do you know what I mean? It was at that stage. So I was like, well, I do need to replace this to write. It's not a frippery. It's something I need.
Yeah.
And I just went, I've always wanted a Mac. And it's a lot more, and I can't really justify it because I'm not editing photos, but sod it. So I did, yeah. Basically.
Okay, so you got yourself a Mac because, of course, you're a writer now. You're a best-selling author. So what would the opening scene be to, yeah, sorry about that, the Nick Pettigrew biopic?
Well, what I really hope would be do the Citizen Kane thing where it starts with me at the end of my life, ideally about 147 years old, in a big mansion, sort of thinking back on my life and, yep. You know, with a row of Oscars and Nobel Prizes behind on the shelf behind me and all that thing. It would be, I've had a few ideas for what the opening scene would be. I've got a really weird earliest memory, and it's me eating tin ravioli. And I can remember the room very specifically. I've told my mum about this, and she remembers where we were. She went, yeah, you'd be about 18 months old at the time.
What? You can remember 18 months old?
18 months old too, she says, yeah, because it was very specific. We only lived in that place for a few months. And yeah, it's, I remember her going, oh God, they're hot. I don't know how you can eat that. It's horrible. And I went, they're nice. And that's it. That's the entirety of the memory. It's the most mundane thing imaginable. But it is my earliest memory. Wow. So yeah, it could be that. It could be when I got dropped on my head when I was 14. You know, that might be seen as an inciting incident that you know, could explain a lot in later life. Yeah, no, I was in hospital for some minor operation, and I left one ward, a normal baby, and when my mum sort of caught up with me in the ward where I arrived, I was a normal baby with a fractured skull.
Oh my God.
And somebody, somewhere between the two, had clearly dropped me on. Do you know what I think it was? It was somebody like me was carrying me. Just some galoot that bashed my head into a door or dropped me or something. Yeah, so I was a baby and I fractured my skull, and they never sort of got to the bottom of it. But it's always been suggested in the family that it explains a lot.
No. Do you know what? That if it opened with that scene, you know, it's like, that's the classic opening where your baby falling head first, record scratch, freeze frame.
Yes. Yeah. You may be wondering how I got here.
Yeah. I'm an 18-month-old baby and I've been dropped. Yeah.
You know, ever since I was a kid, I wanted to be a gangster. Moment, basically.
Ever since I was a kid, I haven't wanted to be dropped on my head.
Yes.
What? So how long would you end up staying in hospital for that then? Because that's fairly serious, an 18-month-old baby.
I don't remember. I was a baby at the time. Yeah, no, I don't know. It's just, you know, it I was going to say I made a full recovery. That would be very good. But yeah, that happened. So that would be... I guess that would be my inciting incident that, you know, had I not been dropped on my head right now, I might have been just sat in a firm of, you know, insurance company, just doing a bit of admin or something instead.
You wouldn't be talking to us. And, you know, and I think everyone would be poorer for that. Well, maybe not you. I don't know. You are incredibly wealthy.
So I should thank them. If I ever found out who they were, I should shake them by the hand.
Do you still eat tinned ravioli? I mean, I haven't had tinned ravioli, now that you mentioned it, for a long time, since I was a child, I guess. I mean,
No, it's no, I don't. I can't remember the last time, which is a shame. I do. I mean, again, it's a grown up. I do have a fondness for crappy food, though. I do like a good chicken and mushroom pot noodle. Actually, pot noodle sandwiches. Now, nobody believes me.
Right? Wait a minute. What? It's a liquid, Nick. It's a
No. What you do is you make the pot noodle with a bit less liquid than you normally would. So the sauce is quite thick, and you drain the noodles, and it has to be sliced cheap white bread with cheap margarine on it. Noodles sandwich, I swear to you, it's a game changer.
How does that, hang on a minute, doesn't it just seep through? Doesn't it just...
No, not really. No, it melts the marge. It's quite tasty. It soaks into the bread. It's a taste sensation. Almost as good as a pie sandwich. Like a meat pie.
Right.
Of your choice, can be whatever you want. So you cook your meat pie, then you get, again, cheap white bread, butter it, slice of processed cheese either side. Ketchup pie sandwich. It'll change your life. Coronary heart disease, probably, but it will.
I was going to say. Yeah, triple bypass soon followed, but I mean, that is a life changing experience, I suppose.
Yeah,
how often do you have a meat pie sandwich?
Well, I mean, this is the thing. Again, it's you know, the film references. There's when Jules in Pulp Fiction says, my girlfriend's a vegetarian, which basically means I'm a vegetarian.
Yeah.
My wife is a great cook and eats healthily, so I kind of do now.
Do you ever hide round the back of takeaways by the bins, eating, like, looking all furtive, eating dirty food?
Yeah, I've got the idea of the takeaway owner just, like, shining a torch in my eye, and they're pretty bright.
Basically like a raccoon. They just, you know, when they, like, in the film, there's a raccoon out the back just eating whatever it finds.
You have to get two bin lids and bash them together. No, not so much that, but if I ever have to go away for work or something like that, she knows that I'm just going to be eating chips. And, you know, the healthiest I'll go is sandwiches.
Right.
Like sandwiches, something like that. So she knows that, left to my own devices. Like when we first, I mean, this is genuinely true. My main meal when we first started seeing each other, which is, God, what, 15 years ago now, I was living in a shared house grief hole in Camden. And my main meal that I had most days was a Vegemite and ketchup sandwiches. So.
Oh, Nick.
I know. What? You know, you could see what a catch I was. it was that. It was food from the fried chicken shop and beer, basically. So that it's a miracle I'm still alive.
You're a best-selling author. When's the cookbook coming out, Nick?
Well, I mean, look. Very, very lucky to live with somebody who is a very good cook. So by osmosis, I've learned. I'm competent. I'm not a bad cook. It's just when it's just me. And again, I don't know whether this is like a self-esteem thing. Like, I'm not worth cooking proper food for. You know, I'm just like, chips, that'll be fine. Crisp sandwich, that'll be fine.
You've got to, I just want you to raise your self-esteem up and feel like you're worthy of some gnocchi. Or perhaps some
but
ramen
go, like,
dish.
Something like gnocchi. People will go like, oh, well, gnocchi, that's proper food. But if I made myself a bowl of smash, I would get sneered at. And they're both mashed potato.
I mean, it's all about the branding, I suppose, really, when it comes down to it. I like the opening scene, you thinking you'd be 147 in bed with an array of Oscars and Nobel Prizes behind you. What were the Nobel Prizes for in the opening? what have you won Nobel Prizes for across your illustrious 147 years?
Well, I've never been a physicist, but I'm willing to have a crack at it. I've got form, actually, the Nobel Peace Prize, because...
No one ever said... I've never heard anyone say, actually, when it comes to the Nobel Peace Prize, I've got form. What?
No, it's one of the stories that I just have to impress on people. It's true, because it's too weird to make up. It was... Just for context, I'm sort of about 5'8", 5'9", sort of potato-y shaped, so I'm not... A sort of fighting physical specimen. But there's a bar in central London called Jerry's, which is like a members bar, sort of quite infamous. And I was there one night, and it was round about the time Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels had come out. And all of the cast were in one corner, just drinking and so on. So I'm stood with the person I was with, and one of the cast, I can hear them having an argument, and it's getting more and more heated. And I turn around, and the guy, because I spoke to him later, was an American footballer who was in London for some reason. So it's one of them drinking bars where it was like everybody behaved themselves. It was a nice sort of vibe generally. So these people are shouting and getting very leery. Oh, this isn't that kind of place. So I walked over and broke up a fight before it started between an American footballer and Jason Statham. Absolutely. I just basically stood in the middle and went, lads, it isn't this kind of place. If you're going to do that, why don't you just go outside? And I genuinely think the shock of this potatoy little short arse telling them to behave themselves. I think it broke the spell. They're both going, yeah, fine. Yeah, okay then. Yeah. So, look, if I can do that, I think the Nobel Prize for peace.
I mean, between an NFL player and a martial arts exponent, mm-hmm. I mean, that's quite a sandwich to be the filling between, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. I mean, it was the fact that I was having to look up at both of them.
Isn't Jason Statham a bit smaller?
Yeah, he's not the giant you think he is, but he's definitely taller than 5'9". That I can guarantee. And he's definitely broader. Because he was a diver. He was a professional
yes,
diver.
Yes, he was, yeah.
Yeah. So, and the American footballer, definitely. Because I think the shortest American footballer or the smallest American footballer ever is probably about 2.5 meters. So he was definitely bigger. But no, yeah, it was really weird because it wasn't me sort of diving in there, swinging, punches, clearly, because I'd have ended up a small piece of pate on the floor. It was more just like, look, if you're going to shout, go outside. And as I say, I think it was genuinely, it would be like if two lions were going at it and then a chihuahua just jumped in. It would just look so weird. They go, oh, yeah, okay.
Well, this begs the question, who's playing Nick Pettigrew in Yeah, Sorry About That? Is it Jason Statham? Is it Jason Statham?
Not a bad shout, I suppose. It was weird because when Antisocial came out and you know, did okay, it was a weird question I never thought I'd get asked, because people were saying like, oh, right, are they going to make it into a film or a TV show or something? And that was always the question, like, oh, who's going to play you? And I was like, I genuinely have no interest in seeing me on the screen. I can think of nothing worse. I you know, shaving is bad enough because I have to look at myself for like 3 or 4 minutes. So the idea of that, I don't know. I think if it ever ended up being a TV show or a film, it would have to be Stephen Graham, because he's basically in everything. And he's short and he's a scouser. So it's you know, it's a kind of a no-brainer on that front. I mean, he's an amazing actor as well, obviously. I'm sort of being a bit silly, but yeah, it just, the law of averages says that it will be Stephen Graham.
What about, I mean, you mentioned there, like, it was that confrontation that you intervened between an NFL player and Jason Statham. You likened it to two lions being interrupted by a chihuahua. What about you being played by the chihuahua, say from Beverly Hills Chihuahua, or any of those other kind of chihuahua-based films?
If we could get an actor of that caliber, you know, you assume you can get somebody like that. That's the dream casting on the script, when you just say, look, ideal world, Chihuahua from Beverly Hills Chihuahua. Clearly, that's not going to happen, but if we aim for that.
Would you voice yourself being played by the Chihuahua? So the Chihuahua, you know, like in Look Who's Talking, whatever, you have, you know, the kind of monologue. Would you provide the voice for the Chihuahua in Yeah, Sorry About That?
I mean, I know, you know, when biopics happen, they take liberties with the truth. I think the idea that I'm a Chihuahua is... it's a stretch. I'm not saying no. I actually, oh God, I can't mention who it refers to because I just want a secret. But I heard a brilliant phrase that I didn't know existed before. Somebody I know is working with like genuinely big producers of big shows and stuff like that. And apparently there's a phrase that exists that if a famous person, so say Tom Cruise, expressed an interest in a project, there's a phrase called, let's preserve the yes. Basically what it means is, so say, okay, say, yeah, sorry about that. Say Tom Cruise said, I'm interested. You preserve the yes. Because if he comes in and says, well, I want to make some changes. I want it set in Los Angeles. I want it to be about aliens invading. You don't say no. You preserve the yes.
Oh, God.
You preserve the yes to get him on board, get the contract signed, and then maybe try and move him away from the... not great ideas. And apparently, yeah, that is a standard kind of Hollywoody kind of preserve the yes. Because if up front, if you go, no, that's a ridiculous idea, they'll just walk away.
That's so
we're going to get the Hollywood chihuahua on board, we have to preserve the yes.
That is a very suave way to keep the project alive, I suppose. But that also must lead to, you know, when you see films sometimes and you think, how did this get made? You know, you hear about the story that the film originally was, and you see what was on screen, and you think, well, what's happened? What's happened there?
Or well, Jupiter Ascending, as it's known.
Yeah, I haven't watched that, and that's entirely a voluntary decision, because I just
feel... Well, I was talking to somebody the other day about that, because I think it must have been on the telly or something, and they were watching it again and going, like, this is the most baffling film ever made. And I said, I've seen it once. It was on a ferry in the Philippines. It had been dubbed into Tagalog, the local language, but the sound was kind of turned down, so you couldn't hear it anyway. And I doubt if I watched it again at home in English, it would make any more sense. Because I was just watching the images going, okay, he's a bee. Okay, fine.
Stephen Graham, though, I mean, as a shout for the lead, is a great shout. Obviously, Beverly Hills Chihuahua, we'd always want the Beverly Hills Chihuahua involved. But Stephen
Graham...
Don't tell
Stephen that he's second, though. If we get Stephen on board, don't let him know that we were hoping for Chihuahua. That's a bruise to the ego, I think.
That kind of brings us on, if we get, say, Stephen Graham. If we go down the Stephen Graham route as opposed to Beverly Hills Chihuahua, assuming, of course, they're obviously very busy, you know, maybe auditioning for the next Bond. With Stephen Graham in the frame, what genre would the film be then, Nick? And what sort of budget are we looking at? Because Stephen Graham might lead some people to suspect a certain type of genre. Would you like to explode that preconception?
See, I like the idea, you know, we were talking about the liberties you play with real life. And I like the idea of taking my, you know, life that's had its moments, but it's been more or less mundane, and then making it a ridiculous action, big, you know, there's a brilliant riff tracks where they take the piss out of a film called Agent from Harm. And they do this fantastic thing where it's a really, it's meant to be a spy film, but it's made for about 20 pence. So it's really mundane. So you've got these guys sort of commenting on it, you know, like Mystery Science Theater kind of thing. And it is that gap between sort of mundanity and trying to make it sound exciting. So they give you things during a thing like, I'm picking my niece up from the airport. You know, I like the idea of just maybe not even changing the details of my life, but just filming it like Michael Bay or something like that. It's just like a helicopter shot and everything has to be at the magic hour of dusk, you know, because you've got the orange sky, regardless of what's happening. But I think realistically go completely the other way, because I have a genre of film that I love that gets no love. And if I ever put on a film night, it will be this. And it's the terrible music biopic. Oh. I love those to distraction. The best one, I think, best worst, is Hysteria, the Def Leppard story.
Oh, my gosh.
It's incredible. Honestly, it's incredible. Two of them have American accents. One of them's an Aussie.
What?
And there's beats, terrible music biopics hit. They have to hit. They all hit. Terrible Wigs, that's always one. And they do it in Hysteria, and I think Oliver Stone does it in The Doors as well. There's the bit where somebody goes, let's record a million selling album. So I wonder whether I could borrow that as a genre.
That's a great shout. And that is a subgenre I hadn't considered.
Yeah, honestly, the John Denver one is another one. The Beach Boys story is a cracker, an absolute belter, because they're not always low budget. As I say, Oliver Stone's The Doors, I would completely include in that genre because it is abysmal.
I never saw that because I wasn't a huge fan of The Doors when I was younger. Obviously, Val Kilmer got a lot of props for his performance, and there's Clara McLachlan as Ray Manzarek, I think.
Oh, no, as a cast, an incredible cast, and, you know, throwing a lot of money at it. Val Kilmer is pretty good as Jim, but as a film, oh, sweet baby Jesus, because it came out in that 18-month period that I think a lot of teenagers go through where they like The Doors. I do think there's a point past which, if you're still into The Doors, it's like skateboarding. It's a bit embarrassing now. You've grown past that. But the film happened to come out when I was in that period, wearing black jeans and a black T-shirt and sucking my cheeks in and trying to look pained and interesting. looking like I had, you know, scurvy or something. So I did go and see it in the cinema. And it's amazingly bad. Because the dialogue is just really.
And so would you say is the Hysteria, the Def Leppard, the best terrible music biopic? Is that the one people who've listened to this should go and seek out in order to get a sense of that subgenre?
Yeah, I think from memory, and I would have to check, I think it's probably on YouTube, or you could probably get it, you know, online somewhere. That's a really good starting point because it's got, as I say, loads of the major tropes. Like, doesn't look anything like the people they're meant to look like. Another great one is they didn't get the license to use the music. Again, you've seen ones where none of the actual band songs are in the film because they couldn't get the license for the music. There's the new Bowie one I've not seen yet that I need to hunt out.
Yeah.
That sounds like another really good bad one.
Yeah, Johnny Flynn plays both Bowie.
Yeah, who's a brilliant actor, do you know what I mean? It is a real shame, but yeah, they were not allowed to use any Bowie songs.
Would you include the Oscar-winning Bohemian Rhapsody in the terrible music biopic category?
I've not seen it yet. I've been told that there's one great bit they showed. Somebody showed and went like, "This is what's wrong with Eddington." And it was a scene where four people are sat at a table receiving some news, and I think in like 15 seconds, there's about 40 edits.
It just goes
around stuff, and you're like, really? Do you need to do that? It's not Liam Neeson jumping over a wall.
It's the scene where the band, I think, are outside a pub down near Hammersmith Bridge or Albert Bridge. I think it's Hammersmith Bridge, and Aidan Gillen is going to be their manager. And it's kind of the scene where he walks up to the table and says, "Hey boys, do you want to have a manager?" Or, you know, and it is kind of as straightforward as that.
I'm going to make you a star.
That kind of pitch, yeah. And yeah, they're all around the table.
All those films need that moment of, you know, "I'm going to make you a star." Actually, what we could do is, because, you know, discos or stuff like that, you can really glam up and make, you know, like a big centerpiece moment, because, like, one moment we can have in From My Life. And it's, I find it hilarious now, at the time, not so much. And it was the first school disco I went to, because I think I was 11 at the time or something like that. There was Rachel, who I wanted to be my girlfriend, you know, and we could build this up to be really like an epic life-defining moment for me. And my mate Gary, because I said to myself, "Could you go and ask her if she'll be my girlfriend?" Because I was 11. So whatever song was on at the time, Madness or something like that. So he dances over to her. Doesn't walk, he dances over. So you imagine like a little 11-year-old go, bah, 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 bah. And I'm watching this, you know, in horror and dread. He, you know, dances over to her, bah, 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 whispers in her ear. Bah, bah. She whispers something back. He gives her the thumbs up. So he comes back. So I'm watching him come back. Bam, 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 to, you know, bam, 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 maybe Culture Club by this point. And he's smiling on his face. Bam, 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 and he walked up to me and went, "She said no." And then just danced off. Bam, 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 bam,
bam. Gary, you cheeky devil.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? It's just how to sugar the pill. So we definitely have that, but make it more, you know, high school prom-y. And
yeah, go big. And I see that brings me to the next question, which is, which parts of your life would definitely have to be in "Yeah, Sorry About That" and why? And that's school disco, absolutely. That sequence has to be in there. Gary sauntering over,
yeah. Big... Hey, said no, and it just went off, carried on dancing, didn't even stick around to go, "Oh, sorry about that,
man." Gary, are you still friends with Gary?
I am not still friends with Gary.
Was that it? Was that, did that...
Not for that reason, but no. things I would want in, and this is, oh God, this is the difficult bit, because it's about, hey, look at me, but I suppose if it's a film about me, I have to get over that. it was just how the book ended up getting made, to be honest with you, because I'd been sort of writing stuff about my work, and it was literally, I mentioned on Facebook, I said, "Look, I've written something," didn't say what it was, but I said, "I think it's okay." And there's a guy, Snorri, who is an Icelandic guy, and I met him via stand-up, and we stayed in touch after I stopped doing it. Just the nicest guy in the world. And he was a published author, and he managed to get it. Again, he'd gone to a dinner party. He sat next to somebody and, "Hello." He said, "Oh, hi, I'm a teacher." She said, "Oh, I work in publishing." And he was like, "Oh, right. So what's the next big thing in publishing then?" She said, "Well, we think like Viking, epic fantasy story kind of things."
Wow.
"We think there's a gap in the market." And he went, "I've written one." She was like, he went, "No, I've written one." He said, it's going to be a trilogy, but I've written the first one. She was like, "Do you want to send it to me?" And he was like, "Yeah, sure." 3-book deal.
No!
He sat next to the right person. So that happened to him. And as I say, we were friends, and I'd mentioned on Facebook I'd written something. And his agent had said to all his clients, "Look, do you know if anyone's not got an agent but is writing something?" So Snorri, being a lovely guy that he is, told my friend Nick mentioned something. So he put me in touch with the agent. So we met up in a Costa near to London Bridge. And I said, "Well, look, this is the job I do. I'm writing about it." And he's still embarrassed this day, because he went, "That all sounds interesting, but I don't know if you can write. So fine, but I need to see something that you've written to see if you can even write." And I was like, "No, I understand that. No, I get that." So I emailed him like the first month of the chapter.
Yeah.
And he said, "Yeah, this is brilliant. We can definitely sell this." So like what happens is, for non-fiction books, you have a couple of sample chapters and you have a treatment, which is, this is who I am, this is what the book's going to be, this is why people would want to read it, you know, you could sell it. So we did that between us, and we got it all ready. And then literally I click send to him, and then 12 hours later I was on a plane to Peru,
because we were
going on holiday. It was like a big holiday for us kind of thing. So I thought, you know what, I'll send that to him, I'll go on holiday, I'll forget about it. So when we were in Peru, we ended up in by accident. We went to the jungle, to the Amazonian jungle in Peru for a few days, which for me, growing up playing Sabrewulf on the ZX Spectrum, was amazing. Genuinely, I was expecting sort of 6-foot parrots to come out. So we were in the jungle, and as you imagine, the phone signal in the jungle, not brilliant. And I think it was like there was 1 hour a day where you could get Wi-Fi. So I just, I'll check my phone. And there was loads of messages from Max. He went, you need to contact me as soon as you get this. And I was like, oh, shit. Like, because the way my brain works, I was like, there's something wrong with the book.
Yeah.
I'm gonna get sued. It's terrible, you know. you know, just for it existing.
Your writing is so bad, we're suing you.
Yes, for daring to soil the pages. I phoned him up and he said, I sent it out to a load of publishers. He went, I've already had 7 publishers make an offer. I was like, so, what? And he told me what the first offer was, which was more than the year's wages I was making at the time. He went, somebody's offered this and I'm going to tell you to turn it down. And I was like, you do know I'm council estate scum. Used to be in poor. That's more money than anyone's ever offered me for anything ever.
Yeah.
He went, you're going to have to trust me on this one. He said, because if they're offering this now, they know it's probably worth more. So yeah, so basically while I was thousands and thousands of miles away, this is going on. And I was, you know, and when we came out of the jungle and we were in Lima in Peru, again, he went, yeah, there's about 16 publishers now in the bidding.
Flipping heck.
Like, are you? He said, no. He said, I've never seen anything like this. so basically, one of the weird things was, part of the deal had to be, I said, look, it has to be anonymous because I have to carry on doing this job. And part of the job is trust with the tenants that I work with.
Yeah.
So either it has to be anonymous or, and this is not going to happen, they have to pay me so much money, I can give up my job. So it got whittled down to 5 publishers. We went and met with them, which was really weird because he said, look, you're interviewing them, not the other way around. They want your book, so they have to convince you. I was like, okay, well, that feels weird. And he said, yeah, so what happens now is I tell them, you're the 5 people in the running, highest bidder. So I was in work and he phoned me up and he went, this is the best offer. And I liked the people. I mean, that was the important thing.
Yeah.
I liked the people who made the best offer. And he told me what it was. And again, in a public place, I swore a lot. Very I was like, are you serious? He went, yeah. And it was enough to be able to give up the job. So it literally a life-changing
wow
amount of money for the advance, you know. So then I was like, oh, this is going to happen. So yeah, so that idea of me just typing something about my job, because I was really at the end of my tether with my job because it was very stressful. And I always say this, it was one day where I was photographing human shit in a stairwell because we had rough sleepers in the stairwell. So I had to use it for evidence for taking to court. And I just thought, there has to be more to life than this.
Mm.
And that was when I started writing it. So from that to being told, yeah, somebody wants, because I thought if I get a few hundred quid for it and it sells a few hundred copies, that'd be brilliant. To go from that to that, where it was like, yeah, you're a writer now and you can give up your job. I was like, oh, right. So everything I've ever wanted since I was 7. Oh,
that's all. Just everything you've ever wanted.
So, yeah. So that would be a nice, I think, sequence to have in it. And again, God, it's so blow me on trumpety, but it was just a very, very strange, I think for anyone, but certainly for me, experience.
Did you think, oh, no, this is, I've oh, no, I've got to do it now. Did that overtake you a bit?
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, it's definitely, I think you speak to a lot of people who it happens to, they go, oh, fuck, I've got to write it now, haven't I? So, no, I mean, at that point, there'd probably be, because it's in a diary format and it is a year in my work. So at that point, I'd written like 2 months worth, like 2 chapters. So there was the bulk of it still to write. And it was a weird situation because the book deal happened while I was still writing about my job. So I had to rely on interesting things happening at work for the rest of the year, basically, which, I mean, being an antisocial behaviour officer, it will, because it's never boring. You know, you always get weird stuff happening. But again, it's a slight gamble. It's just like, what if I have the most boring 6 months of my life at work?
I was about to say, you must have woken up some days thinking, we've had a couple of quiet days.
I mean, this is my catastrophe brain, but it was a genuine thing because I was honestly struggling at work. I was really at the end. I mean, if the book hadn't happened, I think I'd have quit the job either way. It was getting to that point. So genuinely for the last sort of few months, it was don't get fired. don't let the work get to you so much that you can't do it anymore and they have to let you go. So that was a that was a worry. But the really weird thing was, I still feel bad about it, was I had to give 3 months' notice. That was the notice period. And I couldn't tell anyone why. My boss knew. But I,
how did you take it? My
boss is fantastic. And everyone I work with are, you know, were and are really, really nice people. And that wasn't the problem with the job at all. It was just the nature of the job. But my boss is very, very nice about it. I explained, you know, what's happening. He's very supportive. But I couldn't tell anyone else in the job because I needed to be able to just do the job normally. And so I told everyone, obviously, look, I've handed my notice in. And they're like, oh, no, it's a shame. So where are you going next? I went, ah. And I just had, for 3 months, I had to fudge the answer to everybody I met. It summed it up on the last day. There was a guy who worked in a different department and he knew it was my last day. And, oh, no, actually, no. He'd come out and I went, oh, this is my last day, actually. I was like, oh, that's a shame. You know, really, you know, you've worked here for ages. You've really made a difference around here. All right. Well, look, all the best. And then he got my name on. It's like, oh, whatever. All right. Well, all the best, Steve. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that kind of sums it up, really, doesn't it?
What was the reaction like from your former colleagues? Have you spoken to any of them once the book came out?
I've spoken to somebody. It's supportive. I mean, to be honest with you, when the book came out, obviously I wanted it to do well. Obviously I wanted people to enjoy it. If people who knew nothing about council estates or the legal process or how, you know, people struggling with mental health and drugs, they're the people I want to read it because you don't want to preach to the choir. But genuinely, the nicest part of it's been people getting in touch who either do that job or work social work or youth offending, you know, sort of related job. Honestly, that's been the nicest feedback when people have got in touch and gone, you got it right. You know, that's what it's like. And that is the nicest feedback, because that was a worry that I didn't want to misrepresent, you know, what that kind of work is like. Mm.
Yeah. And in the book, you talk a lot about your own mental health and how it was being affected by the work. Do you look back on that period now through a different set of eyes? Do you see yourself as a different person, as the person who was working then and who you are now?
I was still me, but I was me right at the end of my tether. And as I say, and I know, well, I mean, for instance, you know, at the time I'd not had the ADHD diagnosis. So I was on the wrong medication, the wrong treatments. So it was never going to help the way I was feeling. So there's a lot of stuff like that and stress. And yeah, I think I'm a lot more relaxed than I was. I think I'm a lot less angry all the time. It's a very different in that sense, yeah. But I was still me at that point, but it was just me in extremis.
Yeah.
It is a bit scary how close to, when I say close to the edge, I don't mean in a melodramatic sense, but just throwing in the towel with a job, or just, it really pushed me to the right to the edge, basically.
Yeah. You said you got your ADHD diagnosis in the last year or so. Mm-hmm. During a global pandemic is not ideal.
Weirdly, it was, because, you know, I wasn't working in the office and doing that stressful job anymore, but I wasn't feeling that much better. I wasn't feeling that much happier. Do you know what I mean? And I realized I've got to try something else because this isn't working. And, you know, I've got friends who've had adult diagnoses, and, you know, on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, they'll post little memes or quotes or stuff like that. And I kept going, oh, yeah, that's me. But I mean, clearly different, but that's me. And it just kept happening. Yeah, I do that. That's me. And then it finally, genuinely, it sounds a weird thing to prompt it. Somebody posted a cartoon with about 12 frames in it, and each frame had an ADHD behavior. And I looked at it and went, oh, I do 11 of those. So there was the GP sent me this questionnaire. He said, if you score more than 24, we'll refer you to a specialist. I think I scored 48. I was like, yeah, it's definitely. And then, you know, had a consultant meeting. He was within 20 minutes. He's like, well, yeah, you've definitely got it. Wow. And he said, you know, if you got old school reports, your mum can dig out, which she did. And it was genuinely hilarious reading through it, because every single one was, doesn't concentrate, disruptive, has ability, won't even apply. And he was like, yeah, this is just textbook, you know, obvious stuff. So yeah, it's, you know, knowing what it is has been amazing. Not taking the antidepressants anymore, because, you know, my consultant was really good. He said, look, if you had high blood pressure and as a result kept getting headaches, there'd be no point in me giving you painkillers. Because that's not the problem. In the same way, you're depressed because you can't manage your life. You can't manage your life because you've got ADHD.
Yeah.
He said, so it's up to you. He said, but basically every patient I've ever had stops taking the antidepressants because that's not the problem. And I did, you know, and look, everyone's different. And I wouldn't say this is right for everybody, but for me, certainly. Yeah, within a couple of months, I was like, I don't need these anymore because this isn't the problem. I mean, that's the weird thing. I managed to write a book while doing a full-time job while having untreated ADHD, which is weird that I could do that. During a pandemic, yeah, it's an odd time for it to happen, but I think in some senses it helped because I could focus on myself a bit more and notice what was going on in my own head.
Nick, I'll be honest with you. If you managed to write a book with undiagnosed ADHD while working an incredibly stressful job, and there's other issues that you mentioned, I'm a little bit scared of what you might be capable of now.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry too much. So again, you know, these expectations, this is where I go, yeah, sorry about that.
Yes, very good point. So then those are the moments, some of the moments you would like to have in the film, but which moments would you want on the cutting room floor?
There was, you know, as I say, I did stand up for a few years, and I always say I reached the giddy heights of competence. That was me on my best day. I was okay. You know, it's not false modesty. I was all right. And there was a gig I used to do in Soho, central London, most weekends. Lovely room above a pub. They cram 120 people in there. They were always a really brilliant audience. They wanted to laugh, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you'd get acts on that were pretty decent. You know, there was, I mean, it was really weird. The sort of period of time I did stand-up, loads of them are now on telly because they were way better than me, way more hardworking. They stuck at it. So, you know, people like Sarah Pascoe and Joe Wilkinson, Rachel D. Hunter, they all did this gig, this Queen's Head gig at some point. So I was used to doing this gig and I used to the audience. And there was a particular night I was doing the middle spot, you know, do 10 to 15. And it was just another day at the office. And it was rammed, it was crowd, it was full. They'd been a really laughy audience all evening. So I went out and I told my first joke, which was my standard first joke of my set. And silence, like not even like a few, it was silence. It was like being in the trenches in the war and going over the top and pulling the trigger and it just goes click. You know, oh shit. So, okay, maybe a misfire. Maybe I didn't deliver it properly. Don't acknowledge that no laughs crack on. Told the second joke. Nothing. And so it went on. Now, the only laugh that I got, and this woman's face is imprinted into my brain. Have you ever seen somebody who is so embarrassed for somebody that they laugh with their hand in front of their face? That was the only laugh I got. She was sat right near the front. I couldn't not look at her. She was like, oh my God, how badly it was going. So I was meant to do, as I say, 10 to 15 minutes. I did about 2.5. The only professional thing I did that night, and stand up to tell you this, there's the Harry Hill rule for comedy. If it's going well, get off the stage. If it's going badly, get off the stage. Because genuinely most people try and chase laughs. If it's going really well, they'll stay on, and then the audience energy dips and you'll wish you got off stage a few minutes ago while it was still going really well. If it's going badly, unless you are a very good comedian, you're not going to turn it around. You're wasting everyone's time, as I was that night. So I did about 2 minutes, and then I said, well, look, the compere very kindly let me come on tonight to try out some new material to see if it works. I think we've reached a consensus whether it works or not. But I thank you for your time. You've got brilliant acts coming on. Thank you very much. I'll hand you back to your host. Good night. And I walked. It was because it was a room above a pub gig. You had to walk through the audience.
Oh, no.
There's none of this backstage nonsense. I had to walk through them, past the compere who was passing me on the way to the stage. And I just very briefly walked past. I went, sorry. Yeah, it's fine. And I went to the back of the room, down the stairs, and out of the building and out of the postcode. So I couldn't stink it up any further. And it wasn't new material. These are the stuff I was doing all the time. But for whatever reason, they weren't having it.
What was the joke that you told that the person laughed and gave you the embarrassment?
At that point, it didn't matter. It was, I can't remember specifically, but it was just, because 2.5, well, you know, I'm sure as people can imagine, 2.5 minutes, I mean, that's, you know, the idea of time being relative. 2.5 minutes is either a split second or an eternity, depending on what you know. If somebody is giving you root canal surgery without anaesthetic, 2.5 minutes is a lifetime. And in the same way, if you're telling jokes and nobody's laughing, 2.5 minutes is an eternity.
Do you think you would have got more laughs if you'd given someone root canal surgery without anaesthetic on stage that night? Do you think
if I'd have started giving myself root canal surgery with a beer glass, I just think I'd have got some shock laughs, if nothing else. It's worse. I mean, heckling or booing, you can kind of bounce off it a little bit, but indifference is way worse.
The school disco story would have run around, wouldn't it? I think.
Oh yeah, I'm sure I've told them that. I mean, again, you know, if we're going down the fabulous route, you know, that story we can have in, but it's I'm doing, you know, live at the Apollo, and you know, the compere comes back out and goes, "Do you know what? I was going to bring another act on. What's the point? Nick's so great. Let's have him."
Was that your last ever stand-up gig, or did you?
Well, no, such is the vanity and stupidity and addictive quality of stand-up. No, it wasn't. I went on for a few years after that. It was, no, I remember my last gig. again, this might be one to leave out the film. Another Room Above a Pub gig, perfectly fine. The guy was running it, let me, I mean, in stand-up terms, there's all the jargon, and there's a difference between being a headliner and going on last. And there's a very clear distinction there. I mean, if someone like James Acaster now, if he's on last at a gig, he's headlining that gig because he's very good. If it's a Room Above a Pub gig where they paid £3 to get in and I'm the last act before the pub shuts, I'm just on last. I'm not a headliner. So I was very much the guy on last. And I was doing my set and I found myself doing that. I think it was Brian Eno said the reason he quit Roxy Music was he was playing a gig one night and he was thinking about doing his laundry in the middle of Virginia playing. He was like, I'm not here. I've got to get out of this. And similarly, I was doing my set and I was thinking about what I was going to do when I get home. I was just like, you know, I'm checked out here. So that the last joke I used to do in my set is based on a premise that, oh, I read this thing in the newspaper the other day. And I don't possess me to do this because I started with that bit. I said, oh, yeah, it was like this thing I read in the newspaper the other day. See, I say that it wasn't actually the other day. I said that it was actually like 4 or 5 years ago. I said, because the thing is with stand up, and then I just started explaining to the who, you know, paid a few quid to watch comedy and didn't need my trauma. And I just went into this thing, like, you know, you start comedy, you're meant to have better material. So your old joke you don't use anymore. But this is pretty much one of the first jokes I ever wrote, which is 4 or 5 years ago. And I'm still using it now because apparently I can't write a better closer. But it's predicated in the idea that I read something the other day. So I'm going to say I read it the other day. You're going to pretend to believe me and I'll get onto the punchline. So, all right, let's go. And then I did the joke to understandable science. I said, I apologize. This is a me thing, not a you thing. So I apologize for that anyway. And then, yeah, I just never did it again. I was just like, this is probably a good time to leave.
And it's, yeah, sorry about that. At the end, it's, yeah.
Yeah, no, I didn't even think of that. But yeah, I did do a genuine sorry about that.
Oh, that I just love that spiral. You're locked in and you're like, I'm going out.
Yeah, you've jumped out the plane at this point. You can't go back
in. So what would the influences be on, yeah, sorry about that, the Nick Pettigrew biopic, from film or TV or literature or theatre or comics? Would you have sort of these outside influences sort of directing you? You mentioned Michael Bay a little bit and some explosions and some the golden hour and whatnot. But are there any particular kind of influences you'd like to see in the film?
Having said all that, genuinely, if it could look like one film, it would be Rita Soon, Bob 2. that atmosphere, that feel, because genuinely, I mean, it's that film, God, must be what, 30 years old now at least?
Rita Sue and Bob 2.
Yeah, and to this day it's probably the most realistic depiction of living in on a council estate up north that I've seen, even to this day. You know, the downbeatness and the griminess of it, and you know, the humor as well, because it is what genuinely one of the funniest films I've ever seen. But yeah, I just, my brain always goes to that sort of mordant comedy rather than slapsticky. So
yeah,
I mean, it could be Rita Sue and Bob 2 part 2. Rita Sue and Bob 2, I suppose. But that kind of feel, then that would be perfection.
That's a great film and it's a great choice as well. It's not often, you don't often hear people chat about that, because that, I think, because that was when British cinema, I don't know, maybe I'm speaking out of turn here, but I don't know if British cinema a powerhouse during that period, or did we think about,
was
cinema
it
in the
not
same way?
During around about the same time with The Merchant Ivory, very lavish, you know, E.M. Forstery kind of films that were being made, because you had that, and that was British films. It was costumes,
yes, that's it, exactly, that's the kind of thing I was, yes, it was, it felt very much outside of that.
Yeah, you know, you had these frightfully middle-class people having frightfully, you know, middle-class problems. And then you had this Sex Pistols of a film turn up that just had nothing to do with that, but was just, I mean, genuinely, when it, because I'm of the age where it was VHS, but it was,
yeah,
we had, that was one of the videos we had. And I would probably, when I was growing up, I would watch that once a week because it is just stunningly good.
Would it be, if you did the sequel, would it be Liverpool 1, Rita Sue and Bob 2?
Yeah, you can relocate it to Liverpool. Why not? I mean, you'd lose some of the accents that you have in the first one, but yeah, we could do that, certainly.
So what about the critics then, Nick? I mean, what about the critics? I mean, if they love it or hate it, would that affect you either way? Would it affect you on your next project, or do you not give a care for their thoughts?
See, I wonder about that. If you're the subject of a biopic, does it bother you if nobody liked the film? Do you go, oh, so that means nobody likes me? You know what I mean? It's like, if you're, I'm trying to think of somebody who's still alive, somebody who's still alive or had a biopic made about them, because it tends to be once people have died. We talked about Bohemian Rhapsody before, but like the surviving members of Queen, do they base value judgment on how well that did? Or like Rocket Man, does Elton John, because that was really well received, you know, did really well, does Elton John take that as, oh, I'm good? Or is it, oh, the film about me is good?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, what's it? You know, if Jamie Foxx played Ray Charles, didn't he? Mm. Now, no one's going to watch that and immediately, you know, and think, oh, it's kind of an average, you know, or, you know, it's okay. It's, you know, not my favorite ever film. Doesn't mean they're going to think anything less of Ray Charles's music.
Yeah. But I just wonder, as the subject, and the other, I mean, because when you asked that question, the other thing I thought was, would my life have been different if somebody else was directing it? Because I think my life generally has been as if the director of Rita Sue and Bob 2 was directing my life. I just thought, well, if my life had been directed by the Coen brothers or you know, someone like that, would my life have been any better or any different? Do you know what I mean? It's because I think it's I don't know if it's a me thing or a general thing, is I'm very susceptible to life, feeling life, whatever the last film I watched was.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because you'll get people who will take on other people's accents because it's a human thing of, you know, group building and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I think it's a hangover of that a lot of the time. Yeah. I just think if a film's really affected me, I take on some of that for a bit.
What was the last film to do? What's the last film that has caused you to act in that way?
Really strange one.
Jupiter Ascending.
Well, obviously I pretended to be a bee for 6 months. So that was quite a period in my life. No, it was the weirdest thing. A beautiful day in the neighborhood stopped me biting my nails.
Wow. What?
Yeah. You know, it's
the
Mr. Rogers, you know, Tom Hanks film. And the main character is a very angry guy. He's a writer. He gets very angry with people all the time. And he's very stressed. I'm like, that rings a bell. And there's a bit, and you know, and I've got the photograph to this day. There's a bit halfway through the film, these aren't spoilers, where he's in a Chinese restaurant with Mr. Rogers, Tom Hanks. And he does this, it's this beautiful moment where he says, take a minute of silence just to think about people who got you to where you are. And I was watching it in the cinema. And the guy, Lloyd Vogel, is the character. He's wearing a sweater, which is like a grey sweater with a little white sort of V-necky kind of thing. So I'm watching it and then I look down. I am wearing literally the same thing. So I've been identifying with this guy who's, you know, he's got all this anger in his life that's not doing him any good. And then halfway through the film, I'm even wearing the same clothes. All right, well, that's kind of spooky. So, yeah, so I watched the film, and I loved the film to distraction. I think it's an amazing film. And, you know, the image, you know, the message, sorry, of the film is, you know, the anger that you hold on to, what good is it doing to you? Is there a way of letting it go kind of thing? So I tried to some degree, try and get less angry all the time with, you know, life.
Yeah.
And a byproduct was, I stopped biting my nails because I wasn't so hyper all the time. I'd bit my nails since I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I just stopped doing it because I wasn't so tense all the time.
It doesn't sound like you really would listen to the critics then. Like, if you've given up biting your nails, then what's there to worry about? I mean, like, if you can put that to one side, what can critics do to you? Nothing.
And, you know, without sounding like a broken record, if the critics don't like it, it's pretty obvious what I'm going to say to them.
Are you going to dance across the floor and just give them a thumbs up and go, don't care?
Just go, sorry about that.
Yeah.
And just leave them to it.
So the premiere, Nick, it's the premiere. Yeah, sorry about that. Starring either the Beverly Hills Chihuahua or Stephen Graham, depending on who's available and whose yes has been preserved. It's the premiere. Where's it taking place and who's invited?
Croydon.
Hey!
Croydon. I mean, look, Jerry, I've lived in Croydon, God, what, 8, 9 years? And I genuinely love it. And it is the punchline to jokes of places that are rough or whatever. And it is, you know, it's got a bit of that. But I honestly love it and I champion it. And it is a fantastic place to live. So I like the idea of if we got, you know, a big star like Hollywood Chihuahua, them having to come to Croydon. And if you've got loads of other big stars to come along as well,
yeah,
I just think it'd be fantastic that they all had to stay in the EasyJet hotel opposite. That would be brilliant.
Which venue in Croydon?
Well, we've got the View Cinema. It's, I mean, again, this is one of the, because I do love going to the pictures, as I'm old enough to call it. And I can walk from my house to the one in town centre. So we've got a cinema, but we've got Fairfield Halls, which is like the...
Yes, of course.
Big thing there. So you do the screen there, have that as the, you know, and it's 2 minutes from East Croydon. So if, you know, Tom Cruise or anyone like that, Margot Robbie needs to get the last train back into London, 5 minutes away, so it's not too bad. In terms of who comes along, anyone who doesn't talk or eat food in the cinema is welcome. That's absolutely fine.
No eating. Are you absolutely dead set against any kind of food consumption or beverage consumption?
Yes, yeah, because it's the Russell E. wrapper. Because again, it apparently an ADHD trope is, oh God, what's it? It's misophonia. Yeah, it's noises impacting you to a greater degree than they would somebody else. So like noisy eaters,
yeah,
really make me feel nauseous, you know. So I hypersensitive. So yeah, so no food in the cinema. You know, drinks, okay, fine. No talking, obviously. So they could come along. I think it'd be very important for Kate Bush to come along. just, you know, so I could say hello to her. And who knows, maybe something more, you know, a cuddle could happen. So it'd be nice to have Kate Bush there as well.
Is she not going to score it? Could she not score? Yeah, sorry about that. I mean, at least have her involved, Nick, just rather than have her along just to get her a cuddle.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, I'm just trying to think of a Kate Bush song that would be the story of my life.
That was it, the boy with a child, is the man with a child in his eyes?
Yeah.
Because he's so clumsy, he's got a literal child wedged in his eyes.
The man with the sandwich of pies. There we go.
She's going to come out of retirement, re-record.
Here again, the man with the sandwich of pies.
But who's not invited, Nick? Who's not invited? Kate Bush is invited. She's reworked a classic into a pie sandwich themed song. But who's not invited?
Anyone who could verify that I'd lied about any part of my life. I mean, that's important. I think, you know, if you've got the premiere of your life story, your biopic, the last thing you want is somebody standing up and going, well, that didn't happen for a start. You know, so no hecklers. Nobody I grew up with, really. I mean, I have a weird thing where I'm not in touch with anyone I sort of went to school with or anything like that, which I know is an odd thing, but I just fell out of touch with them as well. So although they will be in the film, I don't necessarily need them there. And the other, well, you know, you want famous people, but it's weird. Last couple of years with the book and bits and bobs, you hear about famous people and there's that awful sort of 5 seconds between somebody said, oh, I worked with dot, dot, dot. And you go, oh, what are they like? And there's that 5 seconds with the book. Somebody who worked on the book with me had worked a lot with Michael Palin.
Oh, wow. Right.
So I did the question. I said, oh, what? So what's he actually like? And I was like, oh, please, 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 please. And she went, he's every bit as nice as you'd imagine. She said, maybe more so. He is genuinely one of the nicest people on the planet. And the relief, it was like a bucket of cold water. So thank God for that. So that would be the thing, yeah. We want all the celebrities along, but we'd have to go through them and go, them, not them. He's a bit handsy. Let's not have him.
Nick, congratulations on Yeah, Sorry About That, featuring the most unbelievable sandwich, Nobel Peace Prizes, the Beverly Hills Chihuahua, How to Preserve the Yes, Giant Parrots, A Groovy School Disco Rejection, Tom Hanks Nail-Biting Therapy, Croydon Transport Links, and Kate Bush. Nick Pettigrew, congratulations on being greenlit.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.